of the Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Welcome everyone, you're on FNR Football Nation Radio, Australia's first and only 24-hour radio station dedicated to the beautiful, beautiful, beautiful game of football. I'm Carlos Alberto Diego and this is the Journos Wednesday edition with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. Good morning to you, Jonathan.
Good morning, Carlos.
Yes, so much to talk to you about, and of course I'm getting my fill of I don't know if you call it afterglow of FIFA's visit. Would it be the rubble of FIFA? you tell me what it is, what you've heard, but we've had Johnny Didelitzer talk about it on Monday. We had Dave Davidovich. Lynchy's had his little piece. But you're the guy, and with no disrespect to everyone else, but you're the guy who's all over this. You're talking to people all day, every minute of the day, every hour of the day on this sort of stuff. What's your assessment of everything that's gone on with the FIFA visit?
So what seems to be the consensus is that everybody's pleased with the process. So it remains to be seen what the outcome is, but the process appears to have been positive.
How much has that got to do with the fact that FFA are not taking part as a member of this proposed working group?
An enormous amount. Mm. It's still yet to be confirmed what FFA's role in this in the Congress Review Working Group will actually be. But as part of this scoping process, it does seem to be very significant that they weren't driving the process, that FIFA was very much in control. We've had the story about a number of FFA executives being asked to leave one of the delegate meetings. We saw the press release that was put out by FFA on the Thursday evening, which was just very clear. This is FIFA's this is FIFA's process now. And clearly that's allowed some of the stakeholders more freedom and given them more confidence in the process than they had previously. So it feels like this, what we saw last week, has created a new starting point. Mm. So everything from that delayed March 30 original deadline to this point has been a grey area that we will look back on without much fondness, and we can now almost start with a new blank sheet of paper and say, okay, this is how the future will be determined based on the Congress Review Working Group that FIFA will establish based on what happened this week, with what feels like a much greater sense of empowerment from a very broad range of stakeholders.
Is the perception of the FFA over the last 18 months unfair in that it appears, and what people are thinking is that they have controlled the process, they have controlled the voting of the member associations, and they've controlled it to keep power. Could it be that they really, really, really are worried that if too much is given to the A-League clubs, that the rest of the game will suffer? I mean, that's what they're saying. There seems to be relief that they're not involved, that they don't appear to be a member of the working party going forward, and everyone's saying, thank God that's clear. But is it because of the fact that people think that there was something a little bit underhanded with their involvement in all this process, or is it really they wanted to make sure that their role as custodians for the game, the total game, the grassroots community, NPL, that was looked after?
So I want to take that and try and retain three separate ideas. The first is quite possibly, based on what Stephen Lowy said in the aftermath, in particular of the failed EGM on November 30, that very much is his remit, that he is very much concerned about the totality of Australian football, and he has its best interests at heart. And as he would argue, a member of an independent board, that he is best placed to have that broader understanding of what the whole of the game requires. And I wouldn't argue against anybody who took that and took that at face value. Mm, mm. The evidence of the previous 10 or so years would suggest that there is more to it than that. You look at the way the inability to democratize the Congress, the way the board has been, each director has come on, nominated by the member federations and elected unopposed, would suggest that there may be something else going on.
But the lawyers would say that's our way of protecting the game, because if we opened it up too much, it's this almost paternal approach to the game.
I think that's an excellent word, which would take me into the two other areas. One being, I don't think that's their role. Now, they argue that they have a corporate responsibility under Australian corporate law to do what's in the best interests of the organisation. I think philosophically that it's the stakeholders and the Congress should reflect the whole of football. And if their decisions are bad, then so be it. The game, you know, the game suffers, but they're the incorrect decisions that the stakeholders have decided upon. Which then kind of shuffles me into the third train of thought, which is it's disappointed me that this has always been presented as a club's power grab. Now, the clubs definitely agitated throughout this process. They led the forces of opposition. And if this sort of stopped at an earlier route, it would absolutely have looked in black and white as a Congress that used to be 9-1 member feds, 1A league, and becomes whatever it would have been, 9-5 or 9-4, which definitely would have been presented as a big win for the clubs in that respect. But it should never have been that. It should always have been, what's the best outcome for Australian football? Who are the stakeholders that need to have a voice? And it seems reasonably clear that FIFA arrived last week with that similar expectation that there needs to be greater female representation. The players need a voice. Fans need to be listened to. The 10 A-League clubs are one body, but there are a number of different clubs within the pyramid. The member federations historically have been seen to represent near enough everybody in Australian football at the Congress, which doesn't feel satisfactory. So in answer to your original question, I feel like we could definitely take Stephen Lowy's position and the FFA's position as one of quite paternalistic leadership, doing what's in the safety first best interest of the game. But I don't think that's how it should have been run, and I don't think that's how it should be run in the future. And whether that's successful or not is almost by the by. There is a democratic principle that we need to adhere to.
Absolutely. And I think we've got to... We will make a lot of mistakes. By the way, through this process, we'll make mistakes, even without the FFA involved in this working group, because I'm already getting... we had Johnny Didlitzer on Monday, of course, as part of Football Extra, the chief executive of the PFA, and already getting questions for Johnny about why do the PFA... Why would they be granted 2 votes out of 16? You know, and he has to defend that now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there will be these question marks over, you know, the powerful groups getting more say than, say, the community groups or the AAFC, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, to think that this is going to be a smooth process, and then when we go into the next stage, of course it's exciting because it's football people, it's a broader voice that's running the game, but we're still going to make mistakes. There's still going to be complaints. We're football fans, for heaven's sake. I mean, really, as someone said, one of the questions, of course, the boys have got football bosses, Michael Zapponi and Tony Pignata have got David Gallop on Wednesday nights, and they're asking for questions over Twitter. And one of them, one of the questions that came through is, ask David, you know, what it's like working with the most unhinged supporters in the world sport when you're working with football fans. And we are. We're cynical. We don't trust anyone. Everyone's an expert. It must be really, really hard to satisfy. We almost need Bob Hawke being, you know, so someone that could bring us all together somehow.
Yeah, it's an enviable task when you put it like that. But the dollar figure that drops into his bank account at the end of every fortnight or month or whatever would soften the blow somewhat.
Yeah.
There's an element of it which is purely conceptual. So the Congress doesn't have day-to-day responsibility of the running of the game. It's the it's the representative of the stakeholders. It's the overarching statement that says these are the people that own football, and they pass down the responsibility for making sure that the broadest wishes of the game are discharged to the board, who then appoint the administrators who actually do the day-to-day stuff. So,
but they won't always agree. I mean, that's very political process too. If the more people you have in the Congress, the more they'll want the certain person on that board to be able to perhaps work in their favour. So, you know, if the federations and the clubs, by the way, I'd love them to come together, the federations and the A-League clubs, because suddenly we have most of Australia aligned in our sport, and that hasn't always been the case. In fact, they've been, you know, almost voting against each other.
But that's how democracy works. You know, that's why there are checks and balances within political systems. You have upper houses and lower houses. You have an independent judiciary. All of these things are about forcing people around a table to negotiate, compromise, and come up with the best, what should be the best solution. It might not be the clearest solution. It might put noses at a joint for a short period of time, but overall, it should be the most satisfying to make all stakeholders feel like they have a voice and are contributing to the process. And as you know, as we discussed, the exclusionary nature of the existing system and the ability to draw from that's by design has put thousands of people offside. And whether it's as much just a philosophical exercise to convince people that the doors are now open, then fantastic. Let's go through it.
I think a huge win from what I'm hearing looks like the AAFC might have a seat at the Congress, which, I'll tell you what, remember we were talking about this last, the number parts, you know, 9-4-1-1, and I mean, suddenly you've got to throw another one in there, you know, because no one ever really considered the AAFC under Rabbi Crayham to be someone that could step up so quickly and be part of that. I mean, any other surprises that might be included in that Congress that we hadn't looked at before? Because really the original numbers were member federations, A-League clubs, PFA. I don't think there was anyone else really, because PFA were looking at two votes, so one of which would be the women's game.
Exactly, yeah. No, and that's there's nothing that I've been told that would suggest that those same stakeholders won't comprise the same Congress to begin with. I think with a view to expanding. So, for example, Football Supporters Australia, once they become mobilised and they establish their mandate and a given time to appropriately reflect the supporter community, then one would hope, one would expect the way those meetings played out, that they would be fast-tracked into some kind of role. But it would appear that in this first round it might be too soon. But what interests me now about the AAFC is they're now doing this series of nationwide roadshows. And I would encourage anybody who has an interest in what's been going on at a governance level or just purely at a grassroots level and is interested in where their club fits within what the AAFC are doing, get along. If you're not happy with them, tell them. And this, if you've not listened to John Didlitz's hour from Monday morning, get on the podcast. What John says so many things that are worth listening to, but among them, when he was responding to that question about why the PFA deserves two seats on the Congress, he talks about accountability. And power has to come with an accountability. And this is now the case with the AAFC. Mm. It will be the case for everybody that wants a seat on the Congress. They have to be scrutinised. They have to be challenged. I admire what they've done. I've advocated for the voice that they've had. And then now we now have to, as commentators and as people in the media whose responsibility is to hold people in power to account, we have to do that now. So if they are ready for a seat on the Congress, we have to make them earn it. And I think I admire what they're doing with these nationwide roadshows. I think it's a fantastic initiative, a brave initiative. And this is the opportunity. If there are people out there with concerns, bring them up. You know, get your face in front of the people that are going to be making decisions. And the same with, you know, with Football Supporters Australia. They've got an open Slack channel. They're putting out surveys. This is an opportunity to get in at the ground up. If you if you are the kind of person that would want to get your hands dirty in some kind of organisation, do it. Don't turn around in a year's time and say I disagree with what you're doing now. Get involved. Don't just shout from the sidelines and use it. You know, see it as an opportunity to help those organisations improve. Like I say, the AFC has come such a long way so quickly. We want it to be a good organisation. We want it to be successful. We want it to prove itself when it is, as we're presuming, a Congress member soon, you know, whether it's immediately or in the medium term. We want it to perform. And these are the opportunities that we get to improve it.
Well, they're the drivers of the second division. And we all want the second division for many, many reasons. I was speaking to Joe Mullen this morning, former Adelaide City great, who's now coaching Campbelltown City in South Australia in the NPL. And he's just decrying this whole thing about, you know, they've got one or two boys who are 21 years old. They played at the A-League level, supremely talented, but had to come back down because they weren't getting game time at that level. But they've had to come down to a semi-professional level, you know, where these sort of players would be flourishing in the second division. I mean, that's where it's really hit home with all the talk in the last 3 months as part of FNR. Everyone's crying out for the second division, and that's why I really hope the AAFC are as organised and as forthright as they should be for that organisation to be have a voice in that Congress. The roadshows, do you know what they're actually presenting at the roadshows, or is it a second division model, or what is it that they're doing with these roadshows?
Yeah, good question. I don't know the details. It's one that we should throw out to any AFC members listening. My understanding is it's more just a look, see, and feel about who they are, what they're doing, and an opportunity for anybody to provide their feedback to them, and it is, you know, it is properly nationwide. It's not just Melbourne and Sydney urban areas. It's all over the country. So I think it's you know, it's as much just an information roadshow. This is who they are and what they're trying to achieve.
Absolutely. So there we are. That's the status at the moment with the Congress. I know there are people out there who are bored, and I speak to local clubs every day, and no one talks about it. No one talks about that. They're not interested at all. But it's really important that this next stage, that we move ahead unencumbered by perceptions that the FFA are stalling for some reason. I just hope their reason is for the good of the game. And it's hard to believe that it wouldn't be. I don't know. Maybe I'm just naive, but it's just hard to believe that it wouldn't be for the good of the game. I hope it's not 18 months of personality clashes and they just won't bend because there's so much enmity between the two parties.
I think
parties.
I'm going to have to put this diplomatically. If you follow the club's line of thinking, now clearly the clubs have a very clear self-interest in this, but if you follow the club's line of thinking, they've been asking questions for a number of months that haven't been answered or haven't been answered satisfactorily. And it led them to this 6-page document that they presented to FIFA last week, which contained so many questions that demand answers from FIFA, from FFA, that even if all of the answers are completely innocent, it's not impossible to reach a conclusion or to reach a position without necessarily a conclusion that you can question motives. And that's the problem. And why, you know, why you began what you just said about perception. We need to clear away that perception of anything other than what's in the best interest of the game.
Mm. So what would the FFA be thinking right now? This is, they've accepted it's for the good of the game. FIFA's come in. Are they going to stand back? Are they going to try and influence other ways? How do you think this is going to, you know, their role in all this is going to, and how they're accepting their role going forward?
That's a really good question, and I don't know. Mm. My answer to that is I'm
gut feeling.
My gut feeling is that they will have to lobby Zurich hard. Mm. They will do what they can to continue to get their point across, which is exactly what you'd expect. And then the big question is when this Congress Review Working Group is formed and passes down its recommendation, how swift and easy will those recommendations be taken on? Because as we know throughout all of this, there's the parallel processes of FIFA's jurisdiction and the FFA is an entity under Australian corporate law. And the two haven't been properly tested.
Mm.
There's been a presumption all along that FIFA has this, I mean, FIFA does have a power just to discontinue FFA's membership if it wanted to. And the indication is that it definitely hasn't wanted to do that, hence the amount of time between telling FFA to reorganize and actually putting its foot down. So that will remain a question until it's properly tested. But one would hope that there's too much at stake now, and FIFA's position appears to be so clear, and the stakeholder engagement of the past week has been so successful that you've got to think that we are now in a forward motion, and anything that diverted that would be seen as obstruction.
Mm. Let's take a break, Jonathan. Now, of course, when we come back, I want to talk about the story you wrote about the unparalleled joy of last-minute football winners, not equaliser, but winners. Of course, you're referring
to equalisers.
Yes,
as well.
Absolutely. But before we go to the break, just a progress score in La Liga. Girona FC is still 1-0 up against Celta Vigo at halftime. Of course, earlier, the ball over of, I think this could be the ball over of the season. Espanyol 1-0 winners over Real Madrid, and in the English FA Cup in the 69th minute, Swansea City are 1-0 up against Sheffield Wednesday. Let's go to a break. This is FNR Football Nation Radio. It is the Journos with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. More after the break.
The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Streaming football 24-7, you're on FNR Football Nation Radio. It is the Journos with Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia. I'm also Carlos Alberto Diego. And, of course, Jonathan, you wrote another article between the times that we've spoken, The Unparalleled Joy of the Last-Minute Football Winner.
Yeah.
I think you're referring to the Perth Glory winner over the 97th minute winner over Melbourne City on the weekend.
Yeah.
I agree. I just watching the unbridled joy of players celebrating that, and especially a club like Perth at the moment, who have gone through hell, and they're so inconsistent. But doing it at home against Melbourne City, the money bags that Melbourne City are, I think, they deserve that.
There's something as a fan. It's nice to write about football for a change. There's something about being a fan that I think is important never to lose in whatever we do in football, whether you're a player, administrator, a journalist. Just to kind of relate back to that feeling about why you got into the game to begin with, why you retain such an interest despite all of the evidence suggesting that it's a waste of your time, because of that moment. Because of that single moment of joy that you share with strangers. And there is nothing bigger than a last-minute winner because of the length of build-up. So in this case, it was 97 minutes. I mean, when did Daniel Azani score? 43, 44, whatever? So you've got best part of an hour where your team's behind. You spend 97 minutes, not ahead, it's a match that you have to win to keep your season alive. You've watched Melbourne City go down to 10 men. You've got all of these anxieties that have been bubbling away, discontent with the coach, issues with some of the players. You've seen Mitch Nichols and Mark Warren leave during the week, and you're like, what am I doing here? It's nearly midnight on the East Coast. And then that one counter-attack. Yeah. And you could see it coming.
Yeah.
Melbourne City trying to keep the ball in the corner. Bruno Fornaroli, I think it was, then in a corner. And then the corner's smuggled clear. The ball's fed out wide to Joel Chianese. And then the next 6 or 7 minutes just feels... They just felt like they were inevitable. I mean, it was brilliant from Chianese, brilliant from Taggart. Poor defending from Melbourne City. But everything about that final moment meant that it didn't just come out of the blue. So, you know, sometimes you get a last-minute winner and it might be a bit of a scramble, or it might be just a wallop from 25 metres or whatever. This had a real sense of expectation about it, which for me just heightened the whole thing.
Which gets the crowd involved, absolutely. And it makes them want to come back next time, because they talk about the 12th man. It was like that. That whole momentum that was building after they scored that, the equaliser was quite late, and then they scored the winner. Yep. How much of, from a Melbourne City's point of view, how much is the anxiety in those situations? They went down to 10 men. They've been told by Warren Joyce all year, you make a mistake, you're going to cop a goal. You could just read it all over their faces. I can't make a mistake. I've been told by Warren, the coach, over and over again. I've been punished. I've been actually outed in the media for making a mistake, you know. And this whole idea of the focus was on let's not make a mistake.
Yeah.
And they did.
It was a corner. I think the commentators on Fox actually called it extremely well. They were like, do City stick or twist? Do they commit to trying to nab a late winner, presuming that there was no chance of glory going up the other end and scoring, which they did. And credit to City, the game was there for them to win in that final minute. If you've got a corner, it doesn't matter if you've got 10 men or not, you that is as good an opportunity as you're probably going to get. They just didn't deal with the second ball, and then they had the wrong players. It was Bruce Kamau. Yeah. And Nick Fitzgerald.
Had his back to Taggart, where he didn't open up his stance, which is just, you know, defending 101. But that's the sort of thing that Warren Joyce has been trying to hammer into them all this season.
Of course, but that's Bruce Kamau in the 97th minute of a game where they've got 10 men. I think there are certain moments where you just say, fine, you know, those kind of things happen. Credit Chianese with his ability to just check his run half a second to give Taggart the opportunity to move from the near post to the far post. And his movement, Taggart's movement in the penalty area is sublime.
It's instinctive, isn't it? You don't score as many goals as a young striker, but he as many goals as he has scored over the years if you don't have that instinct. I remember interviewing him once. I said, what's it like knowing that you can score goals? You can score goals wherever you go. And he goes, I go to bed dreaming about scoring goals, and I wake up in the morning dreaming about, you know, wanting to score goals. Like, that's his whole, he's obsessed with scoring goals. But he's instinctive, that guy. If he can stay on the pitch long enough, you know, and consistently enough over time, he's going to be, he started the season brilliantly, if you remember, with some of the goals he was scoring. Let's hope he's right physically and he'll be fine. The other moment, that made me feel the way you've pointed out is the Daniel Azani goal.
There were a couple,
it's really interesting. This whole weekend, there was a few of these moments where I'm thinking, my God, when he took on Djulbic, and you could see what going on in his mind when he got the ball. Djulbic obviously.
And we all did. And that was what was so good about it.
Yeah. And
you could see what was going to happen.
The way he took him on, turned inside, and just, you know, hammered it past the keeper into the top corner. It was just world class, wasn't it? It just felt like that could have been Aguero.
Totally.
That could have been Messi or Ronaldo, and it would have been wow in any stadium around the world.
Yeah.
It was that good. And I thought at that moment, and I've said this a couple of times this week, at that moment I thought he went from being a boy to a man.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. He's shown a lot of promise. He's done some brilliant things. But that was the first time for me, where the he had an opportunity to put his hand up and take ownership of a game and of a situation, and he did every single footstep and touch of the ball that he did, from the pass going down the channel to the ball going into the back of the net, was perfect. And it was with an intent and with a purpose, which was, it was,
there was no guessing, was it?
No.
Just knew it. Yeah.
And you've got Dino Djulbic, who's who's a mountain of a man, and Arzani's, what, 40 kilos ringing wet. But it was, there was no question who was the dominant person in that, in that relationship. And I, you know, I go back to when I, you know, when you watch Cristiano Ronaldo coming through as a teenager, going through these kind of moments. Iron Robin is somebody else that I remember. There was all of the skill, but then the moment where he realized he could be direct, his performance is transformed. And that was the moment for me for Daniel Arzani. It's not about beating a bloke to embarrass him on a YouTube compilation. It's not about getting to the byline and trying to walk it into the net. It's that's the clearest route to goal. And it came from that first moment of possession where he chests it down. There was no doubt in his mind. It was a proactive first possession forward, which, I don't know, it almost seemed to speed the game up. And you could see that by that point there was practically nothing Djulbic could do. And when you see a young player experience that on the field, and you know that that's the start of something, it was almost I don't know, maybe I'm getting a bit too carried away, but
no, let's get carried away. Let's enjoy this.
You could almost, in that period between him getting the ball and putting the back of the net, see the next 15 years of his career, couldn't you?
Yeah, no, this is not over the top for me. I suppose when I say going from a boy to a man, a boy would have tried things because he's seen it on TV or he's practiced at training, and I wonder whether this can happen. He did it because he did it for the team. It was like, you know, when you're defending, you put a tackle in, or you kick the ball out because you're doing it for the team, right? Strikers, and Cristiano Ronaldo is a great example you're talking about. I'm not talking about Cristiano Ronaldo today. I'm talking about when he was at Man U playing under Ferguson. He had a job to do, and his job was scoring goals. Let's not over-celebrate every goal. It's just my job. I'm going to just accumulate goal after goal after the goal because I'm doing it for the team because I want it to win. I want us to win. That goal gave me that sense that the team needs a goal right now. Yeah. I'm going to score it for them. Bang. Yeah. It wasn't about Daniel Arzani doing something special for my career and my highlights reel. It was like, I'm going to do this for the team. We need a goal, and I'm the man to do it.
Yeah.
That's how I felt through that whole...
Agree 100%. Mm. Yeah. And I think part of a lot of people's criticism with the A-League and a lack of emotional attachment is that we've not seen enough of that. We've not seen that, and it's very easy for everybody to go back to Viduka because he is the best. he is the best Australian footballer, and what he demonstrated for that couple of years in the NSL was exactly what we're talking about. And he dominated, and he took on that responsibility as a young man, which meant that there was a trust in him and there was an expectation in him which you knew he could carry, and largely he did for the majority of his career. I think too often we've seen players show a little bit of skill and then leave the country, or show a little bit of skill but not be able to back it up. Interesting that we're talking about Bruce Kamau earlier. He started the season superbly, but there was never that same sense that he was someone who had elevated himself to a status beyond an A-League player. There was talk of him in as a potential Socceroo, which is completely fair enough. When he's on form, he does have that capability, but that ceiling is so much higher with Arzani, and that sense of Arzani understanding that ceiling is so much more significant. So when you see him take the game on like that, you just think, brilliant. Just do that all the time.
And I'm wanting him now, especially if he's going to play for Australia, I want him now to go overseas get a club and do that overseas. Because that, I think...
You want him to go now? Or no,
when he's ready. And I'm sorry when I say that. When he's ready, but I'm looking forward to him testing himself against some really, really top-line European defences. And then we'll know where he really is at. That's what I'm just curious about, how good he is. Now, the way people are talking about him, Warren Joyce wouldn't be talking about him the way he is if he didn't really feel he was really, really a top-class... Because he's dealt with some of the best young players at Man U.
Yeah.
And he has, even though he's very conservative with what he says normally and you know, plays things down, he has said some pretty... praiseworthy things about Alzani this year. So I'm just curious now about whether this is one of maybe a string of these sort of players. The other one I want to talk to you about is Champness. The goal he scored, Ugarkovic's through ball and the way he took that goal.
Yeah.
It wasn't anywhere near the highlight that, say, Daniel Alzani goal was. But I thought, wow, what a great finish that was. It was a great through ball, but what a great finish. He was very poised, composed. He kept his balance and a terrific finish in an important game for Newcastle Jets. I thought that was a fantastic goal too.
Yeah, it was. And he's impressed me this season as well. He's got great balance and great situational awareness in front of goal as well. It's not the first time this season he's made a tidy finish and made what could seem quite a stressful situation look incredibly calm. And I really admire that about him. And since he's come into that Newcastle setup, he's, again, it's similar to Alzani. He's displayed a real sense of belonging. There's you know, for he's a couple of years older. He's come on a much more circuitous route.
He went to Portugal for a while, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's had that moment overseas where obviously if he was successful over there, he'd still be there. So he's come back to, you know, recalibrate, realign himself. Not saying he failed over there, but if he was a star over there, he'd still be there, I would think. So he's come back. And it's happened a few times with some of our... Denny Silva's come back. Riley McGree's come back. And they've looked good footballers. Sometimes when they come back, they probably get ahead of themselves a little bit, thinking, oh, the A-League's beneath me and I'm not going to... But all these guys are coming back with the right mindset. And it's all... And what we're seeing, it's part of their development that they're coming back rather than... It's stalled over there. I'm coming back here to a weaker league. I'm going to star and move. But that doesn't always happen.
No, I mean, it's the $64,000 question about what the A-League's purpose is and how the whole ecosystem fits, isn't it? If you got a player's agent on, I'm sure they'd say, look, offers from Germany and the Netherlands and England or wherever, they don't come around that often, so you take them when you can.
Yeah.
And you just you accept that you do your best to make it work, and if it doesn't, you come home and try look again. I think what, you know, on Alzani in particular, what makes his situation why we can be so much more optimistic is because of the City Football Group setup. His move overseas, which is inevitable, isn't going to be a stab in the dark like it is for a lot of other players.
And talk about player agents, Vinny Grella's his agent. I wouldn't know of more grounded player who knows what it takes to be there and doing it the hard way.
Sure. Yeah.
So what a fair... Maybe that's... It allays my fears a little bit with Daniel Alzani because he is a cocky young man. He's a confident young man. I mean, there was an interview he did with FNR not long ago where he actually came out and said, you know, even the young guy, I expect to be in the first team. I expect to score goals and be in the first team. I mean, that's really cocky.
Yeah.
And I still remember...
I love it.
Yeah, I still remember... Was it Tim Cahill saying that there's this young guy when he first came to Australia to play for Melbourne City? There's this young guy training, this Daniel Alzani, who's ripping up training. He just doesn't care who he's playing against. This was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So very, very cocky. So you worry about that a little bit, but when you've got someone like a Vince Grella and you talk about the City Group, there's really good people around him, isn't there?
Yeah, I don't worry about that at all.
Yeah.
I'd rather he was supremely cocky. He walked into a European club, showed how cocky he was and got kicked 6 feet up in the air every day at training because that's how the game works.
Well, that's how Ronaldo walked in the Man U like that. I mean, really, he walked in. And by the way, you earned the respect very, very quickly with the way he trained.
Yeah.
The resilience he had.
But there was a moment in his United development where he had a big falling out with Ruud van Nistelrooy, which became the making of Ronaldo the man rather than the youngster that he was up until that point. And he needed that moment of conflict. He needed that opportunity to assert himself as an adult. And I've got no worries at all that Daniel Arzani has got that in him.
Mm-hmm, which is fantastic. And other wow moments, which weren't Australian, but Leroy George's set piece. What a goal.
This is the best season for free kicks we've ever seen, isn't it?
Wow.
In the competition.
Keepers don't move. They're just bamboozled. Walls can't stop it. And of course, Adrian Mijewski, his goal, he does it every week, doesn't he?
I know it's easy with recency, isn't it? But I'm reaching the conclusion that he's the best player that I've seen in the A-League.
Okay. Better than Thomas Broich?
Yeah, I think so. And
Thomas Broich didn't score enough goals, did he?
Oh, look, Broich was outstanding. Yeah. And Broich's role in that Brisbane Roar team, and he did it for a long period of time. An exceptional footballer. And I wish I didn't introduce this conversation. Mm. I hate comparisons, you know, between one and... We've had it this week, haven't we, with Mijewski and Leroy George, who's the better import.
I love comparisons because we can speculate all we want.
Yeah, we can, but it becomes... people take it too seriously, don't they? I mean, I think I get more enjoyment from Mijewski than I've seen from any other footballer.
Yeah, I'd agree with you.
Maybe phrase it slightly differently. And there's a story that I want to write, but I'm not smart enough to figure it out. I don't think... Right, here's... How long have we got? 8 minutes? Oh, dear. We might not get through to the end. I'm not sure... Right, that we have the vocabulary required to really figure out how good Mijewski is. And it's very difficult to explain. So if you think about some of the elements that make Mijewski so good, say, for example, how he finds space, we don't really know that because we follow the ball. As culturally, we're attuned to watching the ball, the TV camera watches the ball. The commentators have to call play by play based around where the ball is. It's almost like we need a fixed camera on Mijewski to really figure out how he finds space. Because when a decisive moment happens and we'll say, and Mijewski found space, that's pretty much all we can, the only language we have. We might say he was between the lines or he was in a pocket. It's descriptive to a point, but by no means actually explains how he did it. And then one of his other great strengths is his vision, which again, we don't have that many words to describe vision. We don't have a great conceptual understanding of where he is on a football field and how he perceives the action unfolding around him. The same with the weight of pass. So much of his brilliance is in weighting a pass. Again, we don't describe that in many ways. We don't scrutinize that in many different ways. And when he does, you know, when he picks the right pass at the right time with the right weight in a position which looks like he's in acres of space, it just looks like a really straightforward passage of football. But everything about it is incredibly sophisticated, and my understanding of football, how I watch football, how I talk about football, doesn't process that particularly well. Give me Leroy George. He's a winger. He's strong. He's fast. He's direct. He engages with play when the ball is near him. It's all very linear, all much easier to understand, and the argument that George stands out in a poorer team compared to Mijewski being another component of an already very good team, again, enhances the argument that it's more difficult to really unpick why Mijewski is good compared to Leroy George. So I don't know. I don't know how to completely explain it, but there was a story published in The Guardian about a month ago, which talks about the difference between English and Italian football commentary. as I don't want this to be about commentators as well, by the way. This is it's about the orthodoxy, about how as people who speak English we interpret and decode football, and how in Italian it's there's so much more of a dramatic phrasing. So a player plays a role rather than a position.
Yeah.
And you can interpret a game by each playmaker. So you almost don't need to follow the ball so much. Mm. And it made me, you know, it just made me wonder when I was reading it, whether there are, whether we almost need to rethink how we watch football and how we talk about football. I know it's incredibly profound at 9 o'clock
in the
morning.
I think it's how we teach football. The point you make about how the great players are free. They make space. I still remember going to a Liverpool-Tottenham Hotspur game. It was the last game of the season. This was almost 10 years ago. Nothing hinging on it. They were both mid-table. And I just happened to get some tickets. I was in London. I went to the game. I thought, there's nothing hinging on this game, but I'm just going to watch Gerrard.
Yeah.
Wherever he is.
Yeah.
I don't care if the ball's over the other side of the ground. I'm going to watch him.
Totally.
I don't know how he makes space.
Yeah.
And I spent literally the whole day just watching him and what he was doing off the ball. And it was an education and a half.
Yeah.
And I've always said to people out there who've got kids to take a video camera. I'm not sure if you're breaching broadcast rules here. Take a video camera and pick a player that you want to be. And don't watch the game. Just film that player.
Yeah.
And just go home and watch that over and over. Bruno Fornaroli is a classic.
Yeah.
The way he scored goals, the way he made space and stuff like that. I reckon it's an education.
It is. Absolutely is. And you would have a much greater appreciation of who he is as a player as a consequence of that.
Mm.
But it's not something that en masse we're going to be able to do consistently, is it? I mean, it'd be great if you could have like the bottom left-hand corner of your screen locked off on a player. I mean, they didn't have the
red button. I see they used to have the red button on Fox Sports. They don't do that much these days. But that was more for entertainment rather than for education, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where they had it on one player?
Yeah. And there's the movie about Zidane, isn't there?
Of course.
Just 90 minutes of watching him. I am fascinated by that idea of how we interpret a football match and how we communicate our understanding of what happened. And I think Mirzhevsky sits in that beautifully because he is brilliant. We know he's brilliant. I'm just not sure we know exactly how brilliant because of the constraints of language and interpretation.
What became abundantly clear is why he has been capped 40 times by Poland, which I don't think it's really resonated for people. Poland's a great team.
Yeah.
They've played very, very well. He's played regularly in that team for a long time. In fact, apparently he's trying to turn the head of the Polish coach going into the next World Cup too. So, obviously a great player. I loved it. And there was a number of those wow moments on the weekend that I thought, that just made my day watching those goals. And the Azani one was the one that kicked it off on the Saturday night. So, it was fantastic.
And credit to both teams in the Sydney Derby for those conditions, for putting that kind of display on in those conditions.
You've got 45 seconds, mate. Why play the Sydney Derby on a Sunday night?
Please.
Explain it to me.
It's the wrong decision, but trying to fit in Asian Champions League ground availability.
Just pull that game and put it somewhere else.
Yes.
So you don't have that.
Totally.
12 months before, when they come up with the thing, you'd say the marquee game is the Sydney Derby.
Yes.
By far, the marquee game. Put it where
fit everything else around it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anyway,
and the TV is another one. I'm sure Fox Sports wouldn't have been happy if all six Melbourne and Sydney derbies are on Saturday night with Channel
10. Free-to-air. Okay, that's what it is. Okay.
You know, there are myriad factors, and I do sympathise. However, 6 o'clock on a Sunday.
Please. And there's a school day the next day. Please. Yeah. Anyway, thanks, Jonathan. It's been a fantastic, riveting chat with you about football, too, for a lot of it, which was fantastic. Can't wait to speak to you again next Wednesday, mate. Thanks for joining us today. That's Jonathan Howcroft on the journos. Jonathan, of course, writes for The Guardian Australia. And that brings an end to football. No, it doesn't bring the end to Football Extra. It brings an end to the journos today. Football Extra is up next. And, of course, you can podcast the show on iTunes and SoundCloud. declared. So until this time tomorrow, may you have a great day in football.
The Journal on FNR, Football Nation Radio.